This is the continuation of session 4.
Is the projection voluntary or is it forced upon you? It's forced upon you.
When you say forced upon you,
I do mean that. What I mean is that it's not like you have any choice at that moment. You can't say, I choose not to have this projection. You know, I choose to shift my projection. I understand there's just a lady out there, neither good nor bad by herself. I choose to project a nice lady. You can't do it. Go try. You know, go try. Close your eyes and wish to the fairy godmother. You know, and she won't change. You'll open your eyes and she'll be screaming at you for closing your eyes. You know, she's still in there. And you can't do it. It is forced on you. It really, obviously. Because you can't. That's why that's why this whole idea of refuge as, I wish it wasn't like that, I wish it wasn't like that, I wish it wasn't like that. You know, you open your eyes and it's still there, you know. That's not the idea. Refuge doesn't work that way. It never will. It cannot. It just won't work. You know, you tried. There's been tight times in your life, you're about to die or something, or you got this tremendous headache or something. You just say, I wish I didn't have it, you know. And it won't go away. It won't stop. It doesn't help. It's forced on you by your past karma.
Is that where equanimity comes from?
We'll talk about it in about 30 seconds. Actually, maybe now. What do you do next? I mean, you see her emptiness. Okay? Just remember her emptiness. If you don't get anything else out of this today, going for refuge at that moment is remembering that she's empty. Just remember that she's empty. That's very easy because you've struggled with emptiness for many years. You're wondering what emptiness is. Okay, she's empty, so big deal. How does that help me? Why do all these lamas run around teaching emptiness, you know? Okay, it's a nice idea. What can I use it for? She's empty, which means what? Dependently, originatively speaking, she's my projection. Well, what does that mean? I'm being forced to have this projection of this irritating lady due to my past karma. What kind of karma was it? That to have somebody screaming in your face. It's that you spoke harshly to someone. You said something harsh to someone. Just by the law of all causes and effects, they must be similar. You can't remember, you can't see it. You can deduce it by logic. You yelled at somebody. Then all this is happening before you open your mouth, right? So what's the last thing you want to do to her?
No.
Yell back. It'd be insane. It'd be crazy. It would be psychopathic to yell back at her. And that's exactly what we do. We yell back. And that's why the wheel of life is shaped like a wheel. It really is self-perpetuating. Your natural reaction perpetuates suffering. That's the key to the wheel of life. Your natural reaction to suffering, which is to hurt someone to get out of it, brings it right back to you again. And then what's going to happen the next time it comes back? You know, you'll respond again with hatred, or you'll say something bad, and then it'll start into motion another wheel of the wheel of life, the 12 links. And that's exactly how the 12 links work. Dambo Marikpa, the first of the 12 links is ignorance. It's required. Nipa Duce Kile. The second link is creating karma due to your ignorance. You don't understand her nature. You don't understand she's empty. You don't understand that she's your projection. You don't understand that your projection was forced on you by your past karma. So you do the same karma again. And then you start the wheel. It's like a roulette wheel. And you spin it. And you start it again. And then sooner or later you have to go through the end of the wheel. So that's the whole thing. I think when you take refuge, that's what you're taking refuge in. Refuge has to be intimately related to emptiness. Because all three of the refuge's objects are either emptiness or the perception of emptiness or someone who has perceived emptiness. So it must be related. Emptiness must be related to taking refuge. Morality is totally linked to emptiness. You can't talk about emptiness and not talk about karma in the next moment. Because something has to be filling in the empty. There's a blank screen. Somebody has to be painting on it. That's karma. And that's why the Buddha is always I mean, people like Tsongkhapa and Nagarjuna, they're obsessed with emptiness and karma. They never talk about emptiness without talking about karma. First moment of taking refuge with the screaming lady, you remember her emptiness. Second moment, you remember who's painting the picture. And the third moment, it's me. And I did so, I screamed at someone. You know, fourth moment, take refuge. You take refuge. How do you take refuge? What can protect you from having screaming ladies in your future? Restrain. Restrain from yelling. No, don't yell back. No, that's refuge. That's the only refuge. There's two points about that refuge. One is, it's the only refuge you're ever going to have. Okay? You can pray to visualizations of certain colored things and it won't necessarily work. I don't mean the great faith that you feel, which is a good karma and fits into the other kind of refuge. That's real taking refuge. But the refuge of responding correctly and understanding the emptiness of this thing, that's wisdom. That's the sixth perfection. There's nothing more to Buddhism than that. You are taking refuge in knowledge and you don't respond. And then slowly you use up all those karmas that you have. It wouldn't be fair to end it though and not explain how you could use up those karmas a little bit ahead of time, so you wouldn't have to wait for all the irritating ladies in the world to show up. You know, I mean, can you accelerate the process? Could you just have them all come in the room today and yell and then get over it, you know? And not respond, right? And then that would be, that's actually mad. That's getting rid of your dipa. Then there wouldn't be any more obstacles and you would start perceiving this room as a paradox. Excuse me? Dipa meba. Oh no, that's an obstacle, but we'll talk about it. So, you had a question though. I'm going to go into just a brief thing on how could you accelerate all those bachaks? How could you get all those mental seeds for karmas to ripen quickly without having your car blow up and get them over with? You know, I mean, there's two sides to reaching your own paradise, and the Dhammakaya Sutra is very clear about it. There's two things that have to go on for you to reach your own paradise. You must remove your past karmas. You know, you must remove the seeds you have in your karmic pocket. You know, the karmic pocket is very deep. It's not like our wallets, which are usually empty. It's very deep, and it's got millions of years of seeds sitting there. They're waiting in priority to come up next, and they will. And that's why our world continues. That's why we have a perception of time. They're sitting there waiting, and they pop up one by one. So you have to clean out all your old karmas. What's obviously the second part? Not create new ones under any circumstances. Okay, that taking refuge as we've just described it will prevent you from creating new ones. That is protection. That's the best protection. It's the only protection. And by the way, I wanted to say at some point, you ain't got no choice either. You know, there isn't. You have to take refuge. You know, what's your choice? You know, what are you going to do? Are you going to stay like this? You know, it's not like a question that you have to go home and debate it. You know, am I going to become a Buddhist or not? You know, when you take refuge, you're already a Buddhist. You see, it's very interesting. We didn't have any weird guy with a bump on his head and long ears and any golden colored body or anything. When you take refuge like I just described it, you are a true Buddhist. And it doesn't matter what you call yourself. Because you broke your refuge. You know, you broke refuge. You're not taking refuge at that moment. You're on an empty screen. You are choosing to create the causes to project some suffering. Because your kesa means you're disregarding an obvious instruction of the Buddha. It's a special kind of bad deed to say, what the hell, this is a stupid rule. I mean, the Buddha 90% cool. 10%, those are silly, you know. We know nowadays that we can do those things. You know, that's a special kind of magic. But I don't want to, those are the gray areas. So you want to prevent from doing them in the future. And once you do that mentally at work, if tomorrow at work someone yells at you or says something unkind to you, and you start to react, and then you remember this talk, and you restrain yourself, through an understanding of the person's emptiness, you've just taken refuge. And whether you like it or not, you're a Buddhist. You just join the ranks of the Buddhists. Okay? It doesn't matter what church you go to or anything. You are a true Buddhist then. The opposite's also true. If you never take refuge like that, it doesn't matter if you wear robes or whatever. You're not really going to get any kind of protection. Somebody had a question. Yeah.
I'd ask you if equanimity.
Oh, I like it because we reached that point that we talked about yesterday about equanimity, about really being able to sit in the room while the guy breaks down the door and has a sword ready to kill you. I mean, let's go back to that example. I mean, what in the old man's mind, given this discussion, could have let him be so fearless at that moment? I mean, is he going to get up and try to find some sharp object and try to stab the guy? That's the opposite of taking refuge. That's yelling back at the lady. It's exactly the same thing. It's a lot harder to let someone stab you. By the way, there's a famous story of King Udayana. King Udayana and King Bimbisara were two great Indian kings. They started giving gifts to each other, and each one wanted to outdo the other. And finally they reached a point where somebody had given somebody $1 million in gold and the other one didn't know what to do. So he went to the Buddha and said, you know, I gotta send something back more valuable. What should I do? Buddha said, send my picture. So he hired some painters and he said, go to where the Buddha is and paint him and bring me the canvas. And he waited for a few days and nobody came back. So he went over there and there's this guy sitting in front of the Buddha like that. And he says, what are you doing? You're supposed to be painting a picture. And they said, he's too beautiful, you know. We can't take our eyes off him, you know. So the Buddha said, don't worry. And he put a lamp behind him, and he put a sheet in front of him, and he said, just outline it on the sheet, you know, the shadow, you know, the silhouette. So they outlined the silhouette, and the Buddha said, okay, let me draw something, let me add something. So he drew the Wheel of Life. And that's where the Wheel of Life came from. Up in the corner, there's the Buddha pointing. That's the silhouette of the Buddha. And the Wheel of Life, the Buddha added. And he added all the 12 links, and he added the 5, 6 realms in the middle, and the 4 in the middle, and he added everything. He painted everything. He said, send this to Udayana, and something great will happen. So Bimbisara sends it to Udayana, and Udayana opens the package. He sees the painting. He grasps it like that, and he became an Arya on the spot. And he just, boom, you know. So later on, he reaches Arhat. Then he goes to he gives up his kingdom. He goes to follow the Buddha. He gives up his whole kingdom and he goes to follow the Buddha. And he puts his son in charge of the kingdom. The son turns out to be a bad guy, and he starts doing too much taxes and hurting people and capital punishment or anything like that. And he starts really hurting the people. And Udayana hears about it. He says, I'm going to go back to the kingdom and straighten out my son. The two evil ministers hear about that, and they tell the son, watch out, Udayana's coming back. He's going to take the kingdom back. He's going to dethrone you. He might even murder you. So the son says, his name is Tsupuchin, Shikandi. He says, do whatever's necessary to stop him. And they go to murder him, Udayana. So here's a person who's an Arya. I believe he's an Arhat also. And they're going, he meets them, the assassins on the road. He says, are you here to murder me? They said, mm-hmm. He says, just give me a moment to collect my thoughts, you know? And he tries to fly away. He tries to, he has miracle powers. He can fly. And he tries to fly, but they fail him at that moment. I mean, the karma over, what do you call it? The karma is stronger than his abilities. And he can't fly. And in fact, when you study the five great sins, the five great bad deeds, that son is one person who collected both. He killed an Arhat, and he killed his father with one deed. So he, 2 out of 5, you know, which is very rare. And the point is that Udayana here, he has all this power to to leave. I mean, he has all this power to get away, and he tries to get away. Why? Out of compassion for the assassins. It's stated in the sutra. It's not like Udayana is worried about himself. He says, boy, if they kill me, my son's going to collect two of the five great bad deeds. He'll definitely go to hell the moment he dies. I don't want him to go to hell. I'll do anything to try to get away. So he really tries to get away. He tries to use all these supernatural powers he has to get away. Out of compassion for the assassins and for his son. He doesn't want them to collect that karma. Why did I bring this up? The monk, you should try to get away. I mean, Dalai Lama did run away from the Chinese. I mean, it's compassionate not to let someone murder you. You know, and I'm not talking about that when I talk about equanimity. I don't mean that Udayana sat there and said, okay, just kill me. You know, he did try to use his powers to escape out of compassion. So what I mean is, equanimity doesn't mean to let someone abuse you or harm you in a way that would hurt them. What it means is not to get angry back. When you get very, very, very good at it, and you're not angry at the lady anymore, you might want to punch her in the nose or something out of compassion. You know, but we're not at that level. I guarantee you. Don't be one of those people who fools themselves into saying, it's compassionate for me to yell back because I want to teach her a lesson because she's creating bad karma. I mean, come on. Is that really your motivation? You know, I mean, I've heard a lot of people say that. Maybe we could get to that point. I don't think we're at that point. So you have to just try to, equanimity means as she's yelling at you, you don't respond. But now equanimity has a reason and a logic, and it's tied to taking refuge. I mean, now it's not hard to have equanimity. It's just the intelligent thing to do. It's the educated Buddhist approach. You know, when they yell at you, the best thing is to try to do something constructive back, you know, something kind back. I don't mean to be, we're not like Dalai Lama who can hug Mao Zedong, you know. But at least you can try to make something good happen in the next few minutes. You know, say, okay, I know maybe I did something wrong. You know, can I help you? Can we fix this? You know, can we do? And in that sense, that's equanimity. That equanimity is, if you can keep your mindfulness, you can achieve that tomorrow. It's just the equanimity of knowing what's going to happen if you respond. And you don't respond. And then people go around the office saying, boy, this lady's weird. She never gets mad. You know, I don't know what it is. But you're not getting mad for your own purposes. You mean you don't want to get any more bad karma. Yeah. Shantideva says, when he talks about giving, he says, start with vegetables. It means don't go around giving your eyeball to somebody, you know. You're not strong enough. And you would start to regret it, and it would become a bad deed. The regret would be a bad deed. So he says, start with what you can handle. And they say that when both bodhisattvas do something that would be to us painful, they're already at a point where their karma is such that it actually feels good to them to do that. When I don't remember who it was, Shantarakshita maybe, or I don't remember, but he actually pulled his eye out and gave it to someone who asked him for it. And he didn't feel any pain. I mean, by that stage, you're not, it's such a pleasure to do it that you just feels good. And if you don't reach that stage, you're not allowed to do it. You know, because you would regret it later. You would start to have second thoughts later, and then that would be a bad deed. It would be a kind of a stinginess. Yeah.
So with yelling lady, if I can mentally go through seeing the emptiness and doing all these things.
Good. Not too many things. Okay.
And then not yell back at her.
Bottom line. Yeah.
Right? And walk away from it, but later go, you know, have it naturally come up, oh, you need to see off this lady who's yelling at me.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, is that not good too then?
Then you have to use the emptiness thing on that. You know.
Yeah, keep doing it over and over.
Yeah, and I promise you, and you know, at the beginning, it won't work very well. I promise you that if you don't do it regularly, you'll forget this day, and you'll go on like you were before. I can pretty much guarantee you that if you don't keep some kind of logbook in the evening or in the morning of how many times did you go for refuge, you know, it will never change. You won't change. It's not enough to wish. It's not enough to have a good intention on Monday morning. You know, you gotta keep some kind of record. And don't make it long. Make it about 2 minutes long. You know, some people I know, we discuss this, and then the next day they got a list of 100 things they're not gonna do. And keep it under 5 minutes. You know, we'll talk about the purification.
In your life, like at work, how many times do you work?
I think every time I get upset, I mean, every time someone attacks me, yeah. They're not really attacking me, but I feel hurt. I don't know, personally, I work in a very busy office. Yeah. We go through these big waves of when everybody's upset or when everybody's happy, and you know, and in a bad day, I guess about 6-7 times a day. I don't have to do it all day long because there's no one yelling at me all day long. Some people do have a boss like that. The fact is though, the more you do it and the better you get at it, then naturally the karma starts to weaken. And you can be in an office which is chaotic and where people are being laid off and screamed at and failing, and you're just sitting there like, everything's going right. It's not supposed to be a Buddhist goal, okay? It is a side effect. I'm sorry. You know, you're going to be stuck with this side effect where everything goes pretty well all day. You know? You know, it's not supposed to be your motivation. Failing to respond to her badly will prevent you from having a lower birth. But as a side thing, karma does ripen in three stages. One is called Tongyurgile. That means karma you can see ripen in this life. One is Kenyen Yongyurgile, means in the next birth you see it. And then there's karma which is experienced in the second birth on to the millions, you know. But Tongyurgile does exist. There is karma which, if you keep it up on a regular basis, you'll start to see the results in this life. And in fact, the practice of Tantra is the acceleration of all your karma into Tongyurgile. It's to try to get a result in this life. The side effect is that I don't say that you won't have disasters in your life, but generally speaking, your life will start to be much more pleasant. If you have certain illnesses, they'll start to get better. If you have certain personal problems, they'll start to work out. If you have money problems, they'll start to work out. Things like that. You do have other karmas in your pocket that are pretty powerful, like Udayana did. But generally speaking, your life will start to get very nice.
It doesn't continue to do it. I mean, it's not like the problems you felt that that's powerful, it's just that you were able to do it.
No, you actually changed the karma.
So the actual problem is
the reality changes because things are empty.
It's not just your perception of the reality.
It is just your perception, and that's all the reality they ever had. It's a good point. It's a good point, you know. That's all the reality they ever had.
It sounds like when you say the problem changes, it just sounds like the problems.
Yeah, it's not a... You're right. Okay. The problem no longer exist through your perceiving it, which is the only existence it ever had. It doesn't mean, and I repeat, I don't mean perception in the sense of having a good attitude or not having a good attitude. I don't mean that. I mean actually changing reality. You know, actually changing the world through your deeds. And that, I don't mean, what's that guy's name, that Christian guy? Norman Peel, Vincent. I don't mean just have a cheery outlook on all these disasters that are happening to you. Know? I mean actually changing the karma and they're not happening. You know, yeah. Yes, please.
I would like to go back to this thing about creating karma by faith. And my first question is, I never really understood the power of the sacred or holy object. Does that tie you back?
You mean the object to whom you're praying or something like that, or meditating?
I just remember in all the memory things that comes back over and over again, and that everything is empty and just your projection of karma, except for the power of the holy object, which is something beyond even.
I don't believe the mummy says that. Show me.
I remember it wrong, but it seems to be in a category that is somehow of its own.
No, no, there is no such category. There is no such category. There is no object in the universe which is free of the rules that I've described. You know, there is no such thing. You would be saying that there is something that exists in the universe which is not a creation of a projection which is forced on someone by their past deeds. There is no such object. That would be an object that did not have dependent origination. And that would be an object that wasn't empty. And there doesn't exist.
So, you've heard a story of a fly going around stupa from one heap to another with no intention of circumambulating the holy object and then having a good result.
That's because of those four elements of karma. Sampajjana Tattva. The main thing is sampa. The main thing is your motivation. The mushi, the actual event itself where that fly did go around that stupa. And because of that, had a tiny bhakchat to be a student of the Buddha and to progress as a student of the Buddha. It happens because they did perceive, the fly did have some kind of primitive perception of going around a stupa. Mm-hmm. And that's enough. And that's used as an example in scripture of the minimum bhakchak you can have. I mean, that was like the closest thing to not a bhakchak. And as I remember, Shariputra was sent out of Mangalkiputu. He had to interview all the students of the Buddha. And that was the householder Pelke. And he came back and said, this guy doesn't have it to be a monk. You know, I've used my ESP. I've searched his mind. He doesn't have the slightest sliver of any kind of good deed in his past life which would allow him to be a successful monk. So he advised the Buddha not to make him a monk. And the Buddha said, you made a boo-boo on this one, you know. And that's where he goes into this story.
To be learned.
Yeah, and very famous. He became an Arya in his life.
And if you just act like you're not reacting, it creates a whole other negative karma that's very hard to break. It's almost worse than yelling back.
There's three levels in when we study monk spell. It's called, have you ever seen that? I don't know, it's called concentric circles. This is like monk's morality about women, okay? For a male monk. This is breaking your vow of celibacy. This is being in a room alone with the lady. This is ever being touching a lady. This is looking at a lady. You know, this is staying in a place where there is even any ladies. If you always stay out here, you'll never get to there. You know? There's this idea if you just never be around a lady, you're never gonna break your vow of celibacy. And even if you get this far, if you never stay in a room with one, you'll never break your vows. Like that, you know, there's these concentric circles like that. And what it means for a normal person's morality is at the beginning, if you're overcome by anger at the lady, you have to leave the situation physically. I mean, the best thing to do, if you're not strong enough yet, don't come this far. You know, stay back here. Never be in the same room. Try to avoid the person. Don't go down the hall when the person's going down the hall. If you're not strong enough to stand there and respond gracefully and helpfully, then get away. Don't try not to enter a situation where you might encounter the person. As you get stronger in your practice, try to reach a point where she could be in your face yelling, and you're just keeping your cool, and not in a way that, as I, you know, irritates her more than anything. I mean, we know that the best way to irritate some of those people is to just not say anything. And that's what you're describing. That's true.
It's very difficult when
it's
your husband.
No, I mean, we're getting it. Well, avoid the situation. I mean, avoid the situation. Go outside, you know, go for a walk. You know, when it gets heavy, when there's yelling going on, you just walk away. That's the minimum thing to do. The medium thing to do would be to stand there and just try to be a little bit equanimous. I don't know the answer.
What I'm saying is that if you get in the habit of walking away, you still have to do something else because you can just do that then.
Then when you get to the highest point where you're actually in the face of someone screaming at you, you can respond with care and love and concern for whatever made them angry and try to make the situation better, you know, in a very creative, automatic, instantaneous way while they're screaming at you. And those are all levels that you go through.
You just really have to look at it.
And you have to know your own capacity. You can't overestimate your capacity, otherwise you're really going to screw up. You know.
Don't you think it's helpful? You know, I really agree with what Jeff is saying. I think it's so good what you think. But it's very good to just walk away, you know, because that way they're not exacerbating the situation, but I think it's constructive. After they've walked away and they've worked a little with their projection and with their own feelings, to come back and try to make a bridge.
Oh, yeah, sure. Sure. Yeah. Sure. I mean, but I'm just describing, you know, there's monks who should stay in a monastery and never go outside of a monastery. You know? And then there's, you know, and then there's monks who can come out of the monastery but should never be in a room alone with anybody. And then it goes like that, you know what I mean? And you have to, if you judge wrong, you're gonna make a big mistake. You have to judge your own capacity. You have to know enough about yourself.
And you have to recognize what that pattern is. Like, I used to think I never got angry.
Yeah.
Because I didn't let myself get angry. I really couldn't. I just quit, when somebody yelled at me, I got kind of scared. I went, no. And so I didn't get angry back, but nothing happened that was very beneficial either.
I think we'll take a last question. Then we're going to take a break, and then we'll come back and do like 15 minutes of a quick purification thing. Just so you know, if this is the last class we ever have together, you know what to do about the old karma. Now you have the method to clean up, to prevent the future karmas. And I say, if you don't start some kind of log tomorrow, I keep a little book in my pocket. You know, if you don't record. Don't make it long. Record the three worst things you did that day. Record the three best things you did that day. If Buddhism never lets you record the bad things without recording the nice things. Okay? You gotta, and don't let it go on for more than 5 minutes. You have three things you did during the day where you should have taken refuge, and then three times where you came close to taking refuge. And if it takes you more than 2 or 3 minutes to do it, you'll quit. Okay, let's start it. Start it like that. That's for the future bad comments. Past bad comments we'll do in a minute. Okay, so let's take a break and then we'll do, it'll help me remember what I'm supposed to say.
Sangye Shindu Mithe Uwagi Dogo Nanda Shingla Jibhashu Idam Radamata Kamiyatayami Gewadi
This is the end of session 4. Session 5.
Sashi Bhagi Jashin Eta Jam Vira Vinshin Yende Yampadi Sange Shindu Mite Uwagi Jogunanda Shimba Jubashu Idam Radamata Kamiyatayami Sange Chadam Sange Chonama Chanchu Badu Dami Jasuchi Dagi Chunyen Dibe Sunamki Dora Penche Sange Jubasho Sange Chadam Sange Chonama Chanchu Badu Dami Kasuchi Dagi Chunyen Dibe Sunamki Dora Penche Sange Jubasho Sange Chodam Sange Chodama Chanchu Badu Dami Kasuchi Dahi Chunyen Gimbe Sunamgi Yola Penche Sange Jubasho.
This is a good way to do it. Or anytime you do something that you didn't think of emptiness quick enough, you yell back, okay? Which most likely happened. Then you can do these. Like when you write it down in your little book, you can do that. I have like volumes of these books of bad deeds. They're very depressing. But what's most depressing is to find one from like 1989 where it was the same thing. You know? But I think by working on it, at least you prevent yourself from getting worse. And you do get better. And then I believe that there's this, what do they call that? Inertia? What's the point at which something rolls on its own? I don't know. You reach a point of momentum or something where, because you've been trying so long, finally one day it works and you just don't do it anymore. And many times you will fail before that momentum gets to that point, you know, and just don't get discouraged, keep going. You know, keep recording it, keep trying to fight it. The fight is very glorious. I think that's the Dharma person's shining moment, is when you're fighting your own bad habits. And you don't feel very good, because usually you lose. And it's not pleasant while it's going on. But you feel that you fail later on, but imagine what you would be if you weren't fighting it, you know. And I think that's our great moment of a Dharma practicer. Nobody knows except you. I mean, you don't get any certificate or anything, but that's your shining moment when you're fighting your own instincts. And the fight is glorious, and sooner or later you win. But Shanti Deva says you don't come out without casualties. You have, it hurts, and you have some failures, but you got to keep going. You actually, as I said before, it's not a choice. You don't have a choice. You have to take refuge. There's no choice. What else are you going to do? You're just going to get old and die quietly? You have to fight it. You don't have any choice. You really don't have any choice. What's the option? You know, what other things do people have to offer? You know, there's no other kind of refuge. The doctors can give you refuge up to a certain point, and that's about it. And then they say, they give up. They say, that's it. I can't help you after that. You know? So you got to have some other kind of refuge. So refuge is not a luxury, it's a necessity. You don't have any choice. It's the only thing that can help you. That's the whole idea of it. So when you collect a bad karma, first thing is called tengito. Tengito means, tengito means power or force, and ten means support. Like, it's the force of the support. And support means, like when you fall down, you need something solid ground to get back up. There has to be something to push back up against. And this is explained in two different ways. One way is to imagine the people that you hurt. And there's usually two broad categories. I mean, in the short run, there's the person that you actually yelled at, for example. In the long run, if you're trying to become a Buddha, you just let down every living being in the universe, you know. You just delayed your Buddhahood for another day or another week or another month, you know. Actually, you're hurting all the people around you. It's like a pebble in the middle of a pond. Any bad deed you do has broad ramifications. You know, it's not just hurting you. It's having, when you allow yourself to do something wrong, it ripples through thousands of people unknown to you. You can't see it. I saw this movie, somebody told me I should see it, called It's a Wonderful Life, Jimmy Stewart. It was really great. And you know, the angel comes and shows him what the town would have been without him. And unknowingly, he has affected hundreds of people, you know. And the bad deed is the same. It's not only you who gets hurt. It's every, people see you, you know, when a monk checks out a girl on the street, people see your eyes. Subconsciously, people know. Everybody knows. People sense what you're doing, and it affects them, and then it affects the next person, and the next person. It goes on. So you've let down a lot of people. And then secondly, the Buddhas are all wincing. Okay, like, oh man, you did it again. You know, pink things, nobody's fine. Check out that girl. You know, but you let them down again, you know, and they, if they're omniscient, then they're probably wincing 1,000 years ago, actually. So you've let down a lot of people. Tengito means, you try to think of who it was that, what was the basis on which you, who you harmed. And really the harm is very, every harm you allow yourself, it's very broad effects. The effects are very broad. The second meaning of tengito is, to take refuge, and try to generate bodhicitta. That's just basic Buddhist mental health. You know, so as a start of any class, as a start of any purification, you just try to remember those two things. You take refuge as far as you understand refuge. Hopefully, it's not too fuzzy anymore. And then, secondly, you try to think of bodhicitta, which is to just think of all the people in the world who are really, they are going to get old and die quietly. They have no other option. They're not aware of any other option, and you just think of them. Okay. So that's tengito. Number from jimbito. Say that, by the way. Tengito.
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 We have this thing in New York, it's called Friday Night Class, and the nickname is Cookie Class, because we just eat cookies and talk. And that's for the people who don't want to study Tibetan. And they all end up in the Tibetan class. And they say, tengito.
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 Tengito. All right. Number. Sunjinbe.
Sunjinbe.
Top. Top. Okay, top is the same, it means power or force. Okay. Number Sunjinbe is a really nasty word. It's the word for ripping something out. Or it's actually the word for rape in some cases. But it's the word for taking a big weed and ripping it out of its roots. It's to rip something out. And when you have herbs and you're extracting the essence of them, it's called jimba also. You're sucking out the essence of the herbs. So number sunjimba means to rip out something, called the destruction force sometimes. It means regret, intelligent regret. Okay, it does not mean guilt. Okay, distinction between guilt and intelligent regret. Intelligent regret is understanding karma. You understand, if you happen to yell back at the lady, you know, 30 seconds later, you know very well what's going to happen. You just planted another seed in your mind stream. Your mind does not end when you die. That seed will be carefully preserved and carried on in your mind stream. And sooner or later, when the causes are all, conditions are right, it'll come out. And someone will scream at you. It'll be worse than what you did. Because things grow. Seeds are always smaller than the results. So it's an intelligent Buddhist regret. It's not some kind of anxiety or worry or fuzzy bad feeling. It's a quite intelligent, educated, knowledgeable understanding that you just screwed up yourself, you know, and you're going to get a bad result from it. And it's a weird feeling when you get pretty good at it. You know, it's like you yell and then 10 minutes later you're like, you know, because you know quite clearly what's going to happen. And it's very hard to get that seed out of your mind stream. You know, once it's planted there, it's very hard to get it out. And so it's just knowing that you've put little cancer cells into your body and they're going to grow and they're going to get you, and you just did it yourself. So that's like intelligent regret. That destroys a lot of the force of the deed, what you said the other day.
Mm-hmm.
Just the understanding that you did a stupid thing just helps to remove it. Say now, nyepa, le, lan dope, tok. Nyepa le, lan dope, tok. Okay. Tok again means power. Nyepa means a bad deed or a bad habit. Nyepale lan dopa means to, literally it means to walk away from it, to turn away from it. What it means is don't do it again. Not to do it again. If you had to pick the one force here that was most effective and is most powerful and really, really does stop the karma that you have from the past, it's this one. Okay? If you have any, pick your main bad habit. If it's getting angry suddenly, if it's desire for food or ladies or whatever it is, or whatever you have, pick your own worst bad habit and try to stop it. Okay. This number three involves like a personal vow, a personal commitment. And it's saying, I will not do this thing again. And the great lamas of history have said, set a time limit. You'll definitely do it again. Set a reasonable time limit in which you can police yourself and prevent yourself from doing it again. I've done the same bad deed again before I got to number four. You know? I mean, mentally. I've had the same bad deed occur to me, you know, the same desire or something occur in my mind before I reached number four. In that case, I should have said about a 3-second time limit or something. You know, lamas often say 24 hours or something like that. Something reasonable, you know, something you can really keep, because otherwise you're just going to collect rent. It's another bad deed of what? It's lying.
Mm-hmm.
It's lying. It's taking a vow and breaking it, you know. So they say make it a reasonable vow. You know, don't swear you're never going to yell at work again, because you're going to break it. You're just going to collect another bad deed. So
we get these vows all the time that we know we're going to break.
Who? No, I know. But the only requirement for really taking the vows you're talking about, which are, you know, pratimoksha vows or bodhisattva vows or other vows, is that you, as you take them, you truly understand that they are valid and important and that you want to keep them. It's not a requirement to take a vow to believe that you're always going to keep it. It's certain vows, if you break them, you lose your vows, but the only requirement for those kind of vows is just to believe in them and want to keep them. But anyway, this kind of vows, you should set a time limit that you don't want to.
Can you say, I'll try my best?
Better not to. I mean, better just to say, okay, if it has to be an hour, then let it be an hour, you know? But let it be something that you're really pure. And then what, you know, this is the exercise of building up your mindfulness. You start with an hour. For an hour, you can remember that you weren't supposed to do that. That's the idea of the one-day bodhisattva vow. Taichen Sojo, where you, okay, for one day I'll try to act like a bodhisattva. Do you try to keep that for that period, that your mindfulness can spread to that long, and you work really hard at it. This is the main force, obviously. You know, the karma of not doing it again really helps destroy the seed that you planted from doing it before. You know, I've had bad deeds, big bad deeds in my early life, that I only did them once, but I spent the rest of my life, you work on it. You know, you say, okay, that bad deed, I will work against that bad deed. I will never even come close to that bad deed again. You know, and that helps destroy the force of that bad deed. That's the main direct force that works against it. Okay, number four is Nyembe Top. Say Nyembe
Top.
Nyembe
Top.
Nyembe Top. Okay, Nyembe Top means antidote. Okay, antidote means you do something to make up for what you did. All right. For example, I live in a Mongolian community in New Jersey. They keep sheep to eat. I mean, they keep them in their backyards and then they slaughter them. They're Buddhists, but they still do this. There was a lot of them were sent to Vietnam. They didn't know how to get out of it, and they went to Vietnam. And we have one student who was in firefights in Vietnam. He doesn't know if he killed anybody. But he came to my Lama, he said, you know, what do I do as a Nyembe Top? What do I do to make up for that? He says, I happen to know that your father's keeping two sheep in the backyard. He says, you buy those sheep from him and you keep them until they die and you feed them. And that's a symbolic action to make up for what you did, something similar to make up for what you did. So he took these sheep. You know how long sheep live? It's really funny. I didn't know that. If you don't kill them, they live like 20 years. And we kept them for about 12 years, and then they died a natural death. And that was a Nyembe Top. Here you can do mantras, you can do prayers, you can try to do something symbolic to make up for what you did. But the most powerful one in all the scriptures is the meditation on emptiness. Okay, to review what we said about emptiness, for example. Formally, I don't mean just ruminate about it, okay? Go into your room, say, for 10 minutes I'm going to think about the meaning of emptiness and what are its ramifications as far as my behavior, as far as karma. Okay, now, what does emptiness have to do with why I'm doing this purification? You know, what's emptiness got to do with the good deeds and bad deeds? You know, what's the connection? That's supposed to be the most powerful antidote force you can do. That's supposed to be the very best one. Why? What if you reviewed that process that you're supposed to go through as the lady screaming at you? Absolutely. I mean, it would help you do all of those. You wouldn't do it again. If you really understood the lady's emptiness, the last thing you'd do is yell back. You know, and that's why that's the most powerful force. That can actually destroy the karma. And all the scriptures say, Diamond Cutter Sutra says, you can read it, there's a process by which these four forces in combination actually speed up the ripening of those karmas that you have, that you already have in your mind stream. There are seeds in your mind stream flowing along through time. They are lined up in priority like airplanes at the airport. You know, they're waiting to take off next. They're coming to you next. And you actually can force them to dabchik, means they accelerate, they join together, and you get a quick maturation, a quick ripening of the karma. And it's much, much less than what it would have been. So the example in the Diamond Cutter Sutra is a karma that would have taken you to hell ripens as a headache or a backache, you know, like for a half an hour or something. And it's that kind of powerful acceleration. Don't you already have any? Yeah, yeah.
Does apologizing come into that, or is that a bypass?
I think it's listed in scriptures under Nyembe Top. Now, it's sort of an opposite action that you do. By the way, this is not a morning after pill. Okay, it means. You know, I've heard Hinayana people, they do not have this teaching. It's true. It's in the Mahayana Sutras. They don't have this teaching in the Hinayana. They don't accept this teaching. They say, oh, you Mahayana, you think you can do anything, and the next morning you do this little four things, and everything's okay. Why is that not true? Which one of these tells you that's not true? The third one. Okay, the third one says you're not going to do it again. If you're doing something the night before, and taking the pill the next morning, and then do it again the next night, you didn't take the pill. Okay, it's not working. It won't work. It won't work over and over again. You know, if you can't just do whatever you want at night and confess it in the morning, purify it in the morning. It doesn't work that way. If it's not improving, you're not using these four powers. So that's why the third one is there. You're slowly weaning yourself away. It's like cigarettes, okay? You're not going to give it up the first night. You got to go. Who was it? The lady there went from high tire to low tire to low tire, and it's got to be like that. We asked the Lama. Somebody asked if one repetition of these four is enough to get rid of a karmic seed. And they said, no, it's a process of sapa, means wearing it away. You have to do it over and over again. If you have a heavy bad deed that you did, if you've got something really powerful, and you know what they are, you have to try to, you have to keep applying this over and over again. You know, if you were involved in an abortion, when I was a kid I was involved in an abortion, okay? And you have to keep, that's a huge bad deed. That's a murder. So you have to keep doing it over and over again. You have to keep wearing away at it. It's not like you do this once and everything's okay. You know, you can sense that. You can feel that. It's not just going to go away like that. You have to keep applying it over and over again, and it gets stronger and stronger. And then it eventually wipes out that seed. Yes? It's not, I mean, there's a rule against teaching people too much about emptiness. If it's a bodhisattva actually, if it would lead them to give up the search for enlightenment, you know, I mean, if it would lead you to give up your search for enlightenment, it's improper. I break my bodhisattva vows if I mention emptiness or describe it to you. So you scare me. But I'm trying to say this. It's only emptiness which allows paradise to, or Buddhahood to happen. Things couldn't change if they weren't empty, because when things change, it is a shifting in your perception and not a changing of them. This world could never become a Buddha paradise for you personally if it were not empty. Okay. So it's quite the opposite. Because things are empty, they work. Because things are empty, they can change. Because this world is empty, your world can become a Buddha paradise. You can experience the same raw data as a glass of ambrosia, because you can set up the causes to see it that way. And then it will be. And that's actually how enlightenment is possible. To say it the way the Diamond Cutter Sutra says it, because you are empty, you can have an experience of yourself as a Buddha. I mean, one day you will look down and see a Buddha, a Lady Buddha, right? And that will be a perception forced on you by your past deeds.
It permits
paradise to happen. Emptiness leaves a place for, if things were fixed, then we'd be stuck in a rainy day and you know all this stuff. But because they're empty, they can change. They can become something else. Yes.
I think I had an experience of what you were describing when I first, when I did my peace retreat, and I was reading advice from a spiritual friend, and I just got this really negative place about myself because I was looking so carefully at my mind and seeing how many negative things come up, and then it's all my fault. It was this sort of Western, I think, thing that probably the Tibetans didn't get into it, which is really like blaming ourselves for the way our mind stuff. It's like taking being guilty to the fact that we're in some song. It is extra that we put on it, so then it's so depressing, so I can have to get out of it, you know.
I think there's a practice, you studied something, you know, you studied how to reach high levels of concentration or meditation. And there's two steps in there of the antidotes. One of them is to take action when it's necessary. What's the next one? Do you remember? I mean, when you're having a meditation and things are going bad, you're supposed to take action. That's one. But then when you reach that stage and then you go up to the next stage, what's the next stage? Do you remember? it's to not take action. You know, it's to lay off when it's time to lay off. And then taking action becomes a fault. You know, and Buddhism is full of that. If you reach a point in this tracking of your bad deeds where it gets depressing, or it's obviously overwhelming, you are required to lay off. You know, go to a different subject. And I'll give you that advice too. Change it every few weeks. I change it maybe every 2 months or something. You're not going to get rid of your worst bad habit like that. Work on it for like a month or two. It'll become dry. It'll become repetitive. You won't be making any progress. Quit and go to another one. We have plenty of material to work on. And variety is the spice of life. So go on to the next one and let that one go for a while. And you'll find that you stay fresh. And if you get too hung up or depressed about one, concentrating on one bad habit you have, then go to a fresh one, and you have fresh solutions and fresh attacks and fresh approaches. And don't get, when it starts to get dry and depressing, and because you know that, you know, the same old thing, and it turns out after a while you're just recording it every day and you're not doing anything about it, then go on to the next one. Okay, last question, then we should stop. Okay.
So you promise that you will never do it again. Okay.
For a time period.
No.
For a set
let's
period.
Say with the abortion thing.
Yeah.
You aren't going to do it again. Yeah. You can almost be positive, you know.
Yeah.
But still, that's not going to do it. I mean, you still have to keep having regret and keep trying to make reparations somehow.
Right. Right, you have to keep working on it. You have to apply those other three. But then every day you should review this one. I mean, because...
Right.
Or you could come close to it. You could encourage somebody. There was a very dangerous article came out in Tricycle Magazine. About, I didn't read it, but it was like, oh, in Japan, this is what we do for abortions. You know? Mm-hmm. I didn't read it, but I have a feeling it was sort of, well, maybe this is okay. Miyam Mirchakpa, it's clearly stated in the sutras. You cannot kill a being who is either in the womb or out of the womb. Those are the two divisions of murder.
I did read that. I felt like what it was trying to do was to, that it is to, that there can be a wrong extreme of having so much regret that you're almost paralyzed and that you go crazy or something, or, you know, you're impaired for the rest of your life because of this, and that it was... That it's that kind of therapy they were offering. That's what I got.
That's maybe good.
But I'm just thinking, like, you know, in my past, I mean, I don't know why I picked this one particular thing, but I remember in high school, my best girlfriend went away on holidays, and I stole her boyfriend from her. That's how it, called in those days. And, as soon as I got him, I didn't want him. But anyway, she came back, and of course, this had happened, and, she was no matter what happened, she was no longer my best girlfriend anymore. And the whole thing was just a total mess, she was no longer his wife, I mean, everything. And so I've tried to be very careful about this kind of thing, But I keep wondering, if I went off.
Overdone it?
No, is it still lurking there? I'm waiting. I mean, am I still going to have to pay for that one? Or do you try and work on emptiness? I mean, is that the ultimate of
It doesn't hurt to keep... Overkill doesn't hurt. As long as it doesn't get into paralysis.
Right.
It doesn't hurt, Make sure it's gone. And then there reaches a point where you have to believe it's purified, and it's important to know that it's purified. It's the big thing is at the moment of death, how much you consciously, a large part of it is at the moment of death. How much is still on your mind?
Yeah, right.
And if you have a near death experience and you start to regret all these things about your life, then they're not purified yet, and you probably have to work on them.
Well, it feels to me in this case, when you put it in that perspective, it's like for, many of the things that I've done in the past that I have regret for, I can't say that I've purified it, but I can tell that I truly have regret. Yeah. I mean, that's the one thing that I can feel.
That's the best thing. Okay, we'll do anything. Sorry. let me wrap up. Let me see here. Just that it's a really, you know, I felt kind of weird coming to teach here because I'm really just an American guy, you know, and I, you know, I was a little nervous about coming to teach here. And I repeat what I said the first night when I came. Vajrapani is very famous all over the world. You know, I was part of a small center. We were very jealous of Vajrapani because they did so many good things. And it's really a great thing. You know, everything you've done here is really, really great. The place is great. The stupa and the dedication to your root lama is the highest practice you can do. And everything is just really, really perfect. And all the teachers who have come here and the whole scene is really great. And I know that it doesn't happen. It's not sangidupa. It's not spontaneous. It takes work. And it still takes work. And many people struggled to make this place here. And just for the opportunity for us to have a few hours of classes, there's many days and months of work that go into the maintaining the place and things like that. So I think we should rejoice in that. You know, the place, it's a great institution. It's more important than the White House or something. You know, seriously, if you think in terms of ultimate good, this place here is more important than that institution, or Wall Street, or whatever. These houses are more important than that. And just keep it up, you know. The whole world, I mean, the Dharma world is hoping that you keep it up. And it's not, it's not easy. You don't get any positive reinforcement much, you know. You don't get anyone coming and telling you how great it is. And, you know, mostly if you're in charge of a Dharma place or you help with the maintaining it or you help with financing it, all you get is complaints. You know, you get people telling you that isn't how you should have spent your money. I don't like this place, you know, or this place is too cold or too hot, or I don't like the food, you know, why didn't you do this and why didn't you do that? And the last thing you get is somebody saying what a great thing you did. And you gotta just keep going on. That's kind of refuge. When you talk about refuge, when you start to get depressed about, you know, no matter how much you do, it doesn't seem to, no one's happy. That's a kind of refuge too. In other words, you have to take refuge in your knowledge that you're doing the right thing, that you're doing the very best thing. And taking refuge in that means not getting discouraged and not ever allowing that to happen, you know. It's you when you're doing the right reaction to the lady and you're nice to her and then still she attacks you, take refuge again, you know. Refuge to me means that. It means in the face of repeated disappointments, you keep doing what you know is virtuous, you know. You just keep going. That's really refuge. And keep it up with Vajrapani, too. All right, that's right.
Yes.
This is the end of Session 5. You have been listening to The Real Meaning of Refuge with Geshe Michael Roach. To contact us on other courses available or for further information, please check our website at www.world-view.org.